Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition, Martin Wehmeyer's crisis communication professional Angela Minicucci and senior communications strategist Adam Beitley share their thoughts on Democrats' fall policy agenda, as well as emotions surrounding Michigan's reported lack in population growth. Automotive journalist Jordan Grislewski of the Detroit News and Paul Eisenstein of Headlight News discuss the UAW strike against Detroit's Big Three automakers. Policy specialist Heath Lowry of the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence explains legislation banning someone convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor from owning a gun for 8 years. Now here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I am pretty excited about the segments we have for today, especially a journalism roundtable discussion on the UAW strike with automotive reporters Jordan Grislewski of the Detroit News and Paul Eisenstein of Headlight.News. But to begin everything, we have what I have nicknamed a Martin Wehmeyer double trouble roundtable. And I was going to do like the little sirens, like,
you can still put them in, Sam. Just do it.
From authentic, from the heart. We have Adam Beitley, the Public Relations Agency's Vice President of Public Affairs and the previous Director of Digital Media for Senate Republicans while they were in the majority, and Angela Minicucci, a Martin Wehmeyer partner who formerly served as Communications Director for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. And of course, we also have our editor, Kyle Malin, on with us today. And I want to start with a very vague question that you all can go in any direction with. Who so far in September 2023 do you think has their act most together? And I'll start with you, Angela.
Man, if you're thinking candidates, I think it's kind of slim pickings on the Republican side, even though it seems like a million people have thrown in their hat. And then I think in general, if you're looking at the parties, I think the Democratic Party is the one that really has been leading kind of some kind of coalition, I guess, or not coalition, but collaboration in terms of who all they're ready to rally behind. They know that they've got a pretty solid party, a lot less infighting and a lot of people that are willing to work together to find solutions on issues, where if you go to the Republican Party, I think they're more interested in just fighting with one another at the moment to see who can hold on to power at the top.
How about you, Adam?
Yeah, you know, I'd agree with kind of where Angela said things were heading there. You know, I think the governor and the majority leader in the Senate and the speaker in the House, you know, they've just been firing on all cylinders on, you know, accomplishing their priorities throughout the year. You know, and then the governor kind of resetting for the fall with the What's Next address really just helps kind of keep the party action forward and, you know, gives everyone kind of a direction to rally towards versus House Republicans have set up an okay operation as far as kind of being a counter check maybe to the Democrat majorities, but it's just tough to see where there's going to be a lot of success in being opposed to everything. At some point, there does need to be some kind of coming together. And then as far as the parties themselves are concerned in that political sense, I mean, the Michigan Republican Party is just fading further into irrelevance with each passing day. Just feels like as a political operation, they're just completely falling off a cliff, at least as far as I can see.
How about you, Kyle? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that of the people who have their act together, I think Mike Rogers is showing right now that he has his act together. He's got a professional operation going on over there. I think his rollout on his U.S. Senate campaign has gone probably better than expected for him. I think he's doing actually pretty well right now. He is going to go to this Mackinac conference this weekend, but he's not going to be spending a ton of time there. He'll kind of blow in on Saturday and then blow right back out. He is going to be in Midland for the Kristi Noem talk for the Midland Republican Party. I think he's doing a really good job. And I think that, you know, if he had any support at all from the Republican Party apparatus, he would be in a pretty decent position to take on who we presume would be the Democrat. And, Alyssa Slotkin, who has always had her act together. I mean, that's not a September thing. That's just kind of like an every month thing. So those two, I think, seem to be doing the best as far as keeping their act together. I hear what Adam's saying here as far as the Democratic legislature and the governor. September, I mean, we're just starting off. I mean, what we're only really like the second and a half week in here, but I think the topics that they're going to be handling though this fall session are going to be a lot different than kind of the layups they were able to do in the spring session. The topics that they were addressing there were, while they were heady issues, and I would say the red flag legislation was pretty involved. I think of everything they did, that was the most involved. They're getting into some real complex policy initiatives here and a real big list here from the governor. And it's going to be tough for them to slog through this. I mean, they may have their act together, but they need 56 votes all the time in the House. And they've already proven that's a hard thing to do. And I've seen already a couple things on agendas for either the committee or the House floor that haven't come to pass already here. And I think we're going to see more of that as, you know, leadership suggests, oh yeah, this would be, or a member suggests, hey, I think it would be a great idea to take up this issue, and then only to get into committee and realize, oh, you know what, you know, we actually don't have time, or we don't really have the support, or we're actually not going to take up, you know, mandating positions on, you know, let's say a board of directors for females. You know, that was just one example of a few that we've seen where they had to, you know, slam on the brakes.
Well, not a lot of time if we're actually looking at an early November wrap up time frame. So it's gonna fly by with the volume of priorities they've outlined in the timeline that exists right now.
That was definitely a big question that I had with kind of wanting to ask this: who has their act together and who doesn't? Is this the time period where we start to see a bit of chaos transpire? Because again, Democrats have ultimately given themselves a limited timeline, potentially ending either late October, early November. And some of these big policy issues that if it were a normal policy making term, you would see these be in the works for a 2-year period. Do I dare make that observation? Yeah. I especially think about Senate Dems, their clean energy future plan legislation, where even though there wasn't a traditional committee hearing on it, you had Senators Singh and Geis give an update preview during that committee time. And they said that instead of having that 100% clean energy standard be by 2035, they're going to boost it up to 2040. I guess that's my question here. You're going to see a lot of policies start to have tweaks to be more realistic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's part of, you know, being in leadership and being in charge is that willingness to compromise and be able to listen to input from other sides and outside folks that are going to be impacted by policy change. And then being able to adjust and adapt to that feedback, you know, moving from 2035 to 2040 is kind of, I think, some proof of that, dealing with the realities of the situation and making those adjustments when needed. That to me just shows that they're working hard on this issue, and they're trying to figure out a way that they can get this passed and get those votes to get this achieved. Otherwise, digging your heels in on 2035 and then, as Kyle kind of pointed out, these are really heavy lifts on really complicated issues. You got to be able to make those adjustments if you're going to get stuff across the finish line.
Got to be willing to compromise. And it's definitely something that's going to be necessary if we want Michigan to continue to be nationally, but also internationally competitive in the energy space. And so for them to be able to find compromise and still work towards progress, that is, like Adam said, part of being in leadership and making sure that you're continuing to move forward.
You know, Angela and Adam, as people that work in the public affairs and policy realm, what are kind of some big issues that you're focused on currently?
One of the big things that I'm focused on right now is working on getting our roads fixed, fixing the damn roads, as the governor says. You know, we've got a problem here where for decades we've underinvested in our infrastructure network, and it's very, very, very apparent. You know, some estimates have it as a $9 billion revenue shortfall in this space. And yeah, we're seeing a lot of road construction projects happening around the state during construction season, but that's really just scratching at the surface of the overall larger problem that, you know, the state is trying to deal with. So that's an issue I've been working with MITA closely on to help them achieve some policy success there to finally get our roads up into good shape so that we have, you know, safe roads. And really it's also an advertisement to the rest of the country as people visit here and they see the poor state of our infrastructure. Would someone really consider making Michigan their home if they're driving on these awful surfaces all over the place? You know, I think that's a question people need to ask.
Well, and I think that plays into some broader issues that we're working on with some clients in Michigan Future. I think does a really nice job kind of teeing up what's going on with this, is that Michigan's competitiveness and our economy are definitely impacted by the quality of our infrastructure, but also just the way that we're approaching keeping talent in this state. And the truth is we're just not keeping talent in this state. And I think that's why the governor pulled this issue of population into the Growing Michigan Together Council. Young talent doesn't want to be in Michigan. This isn't the place to be. And especially post-pandemic, where you can pretty much live and work wherever you want, it's going to be a difficult challenge for Michigan employers to adjust to. And part of what Michigan Future really focuses on is making sure that we're retaining the types of jobs and the type of employers here in the state that are attractive to young talent. And Michigan historically kind of relied on the big three and making sure that we had those kind of line workers, the factories, and that isn't attractive to young talent. It's those with going through our colleges here in Michigan, leaving and taking their, you know, 4-year degree elsewhere and living in cities that have more to offer and are more exciting to young talent and are easier to walk and have nightlife and cultural attractions that we just don't have in any of our communities, really. And so that's going to be a huge priority for a number of our clients. And I think the business community in general is really going to be watching closely to see what comes out of that council and making sure that, you know, whatever policy gets proposed is actually going to indeed make us more competitive nationally, but really truly internationally at this point. We're losing talent, not just to other states, but to other countries right now.
It just kind of seems like that overall has been a developing issue in terms of our population becoming stagnant. And a part of me almost wonders, is anything that this population council is going to recommend, is that ultimately just going to be a Band-Aid?
Well, I don't know, Sam. I mean, I think that if you talk about the population stagnation, I mean, we've been seeing that since the 1970s. And this whole idea of, you know, the last person to leave Michigan, turn off the lights. I mean, I heard that saying back in the 1980s. So I think this is something that gets revisited every once in a while. I mean, kids have been leaving Michigan and then coming back. Sometimes they come back, sometimes they don't. I mean, I can count myself as one of those. I left Michigan for 5 years. I came back later because, you know, the bright lights, big city, Chicago, New York, man, it's kind of exciting to go and do something else, do something different. My sister left. She didn't come back. She stayed in Chicago. I did come back. You know, some people do, some people don't. Is there anything that can be done on the policy front on that? Or is that just kind of the realities of the situation, that California is just a bit more exciting than Michigan? It just is. New York is a bit more exciting. Florida's got some nice weather, you know, unless you're there right now. I mean, there's some geographical things involved in that. There's societal things. And I don't know if public policy is really where you're going to solve any of that, or if that's just a reason or an excuse to do the things you wanted to do in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I think investing in our cities, though, you know, making them attractive right away to folks as they graduate college, that would help retain these folks as they consider where they're going to start their careers. You know, once people are graduating from Michigan State and Ann Arbor, why not put our best foot forward to keep them here? Instead of hoping for the return 5, 10 years, 15 years down the road.
But Grand Rapids looks pretty good, Adam. I mean, Grand Rapids, I mean, it's pretty cool now. Royal Oak's nice. I mean, there's some suburban areas there in Detroit. That's good. Detroit's starting to rebound a little bit. I mean, but I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, I guess I'm wondering what kind of public policy they're going to cook up that we hadn't thought about in the last 50 years that's going to keep these kids around. I just have an impression that this is something that the governor wants to do to give herself some political cover down the line. At least I think that's a suggestion that we got to think seriously about. I guess I'm just skeptical that this group is going to come up with something that we haven't thought of already.
I don't think that's unfair. I think a lot of people are skeptical, and we'll be watching very closely what comes out of the Growing Michigan Together Council and whether or not that's actually going to bring policy changes that are going to result in us moving our state forward a little bit. I think the bigger issue is that Michigan has relied on a strategy economically that's put a lot of weight and a lot of effort behind building these plants, building these low income jobs that are not reliant on having a 4-year degree. And so we're losing talent. We're losing very highly qualified talent to other states. And I think that part of that is, you know, we only have really the Metro Detroit area in Grand Rapids. Other than that, there are very few places in this state that are attractive to talent. And we're a big state. We've got a lot of other areas that could use some attention. I mean, I think Traverse City is trying, but we're in the UP. I mean, we've got Marquette, but that's just a little dot in the middle. So I think that there's more to be done to build these communities where people want to immediately invest and do what they start their career here and then make this a priority for the rest of their life. Maybe they'll have a vacation home somewhere else, but we don't want to be a destination people come back to just to die. And that's a point where I think we're struggling, where people come back later in life, either to take care of ailing loved ones or their family members, but not necessarily because this is a place where they want to live and build their family.
You know, speaking of plants, who wants to talk about the UAW strike? I mean, obviously, this is already a historic strike with the UAW going against all three Detroit automakers simultaneously at the same time. But I do want to bring up a conversation about the political messaging around the strike. How do you feel that the message, both from Republicans and Democrats, how do you think the message has changed from the 2019 strike against General Motors in comparison to today?
You've pointed out the historical significance of this. All three, all Detroit Big Three automakers are facing a strike all at the same time, which has never happened. But with the strike starting out as these kind of targeted pushes and not, you know, across the board, you know, it's going to have this kind of slow burn, slow trickle effect as it plays out in the coming days and weeks, potentially. I think on the political side, we're in this interesting environment where, historically, Democrats have been very aligned with the UAW. And of course, they were all out rallying with them on Friday. But also the Republicans have entered an interesting angle of this as well on the EV front, and really trying to connect with those UAW workers on EVs kind of being a threat to their economic future, as far as it goes with the big three moving their production away from the internal combustion engine. Does this peel off enough UAW voters towards the Republican camp? I'm not sure. Trump was effective in 2016 at getting into that labor pool a little bit and getting some support from there that proved pivotal during that election cycle. Is he able, or folks aligned with him, able to capitalize on this at this moment? I'm not 100% sure. I mean, there's not a unified Republican message on this that I have seen yet, but definitely from the party leadership side, as far as it goes, and Trump and his forces, they seem to be playing hard into the EV angle of where the UAW is voicing their concerns.
Well, and I can see that as really more of a way to advance party priorities than really to cater to what the UAW is asking for. The UAW isn't necessarily throwing up a ton of fit over UVs. I think job security is part of what they're concerned about. But a lot of what we're seeing, I think, is kind of the pandemic remnants of people looking for a very different work environment in 2023 than existed in 2019, even. And so what comes out of these negotiations, I think, needs to be a little bit more tailored to what the UAW is asking for and paying attention to than just what a party priority may be. And so I think that we're going to definitely see that on the Dem side, and we already have, and we will continue to. Whether or not that's swaying any of the big three just yet, I'm not sure that they're really feeling the heat just yet. So there is probably, I think slow burn is a good way to say it, Adam. There's probably more to come, more plants, more closures, more striking, that's going to have a broader ripple effect on the economy, not just these employers that we have yet to see. And that is really going to come down to what's happening at the bargaining table. It sounds like there have been some talks to make some progress on some of the things they're asking for. The cost of living adjustment is one I've heard a lot of discussion around. But even then, is that going to be enough for them to reach an agreement? I'm not sure. And so we may see this continue to be an issue over the next couple of weeks, maybe months.
As the big three moves into that electric vehicle production, you know, that production requires less workers. It just does. And so that's something that the UAW is grappling with as they go through these negotiations, is how do they protect their labor force? How do they protect their members and at least stop what's likely to be a very big drain on the number of UAW workers needed at these plants. So that's, you know, that's kind of where everyone's in this battle as to what does that look like in a future contract.
When I think about in terms of messaging, though, I feel like we're at a period where a lot of people, regardless of where you fall on the political line, you're going to be very, very careful about what you say right now. And I say that as someone who did cover the stand-up rally this previous Friday that was in Detroit. It was headlined by Sean Fain, the new UAW president, and progressive U.S. Senator, former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. And it was kind of interesting because you would expect Sean Fain and Bernie Sanders wouldn't be in the same lineup of speakers as Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And it was very interesting to see it go from Governor Whitmer, whose remarks were very much along the lines of, you know, I love my brothers and sisters in labor, and I'm here for you. And then you go over to Sean Fain, who says, we are being accused of starting a class war, but this class war has been going on for 40 years. And those are two very completely different messages. And I guess I wonder, how do these two realms clash together because of the new dynamics that we see at play with the present day UAW and the present day nature of this strike?
Well, I think that's been, you know, we've seen this for several years now, this kind of play out as this class warfare argument and the kind of resentment against the big CEOs and the people that make millions of dollars that lead these companies. And Republicans and Democrats have both made an attempt, especially in this new version of the Trump Republican Party, to kind of play into that class warfare, Bernie Sanders obviously being the poster child of that on the Democrat side. To be honest, I don't know where this goes. The traditional alignment that we're used to of, you know, the Democrats and labor, that's not where that sits today is not the way it's always been. And I think Democrats are making a good effort to try to hold on to it. It's also difficult when you're leading the nation and the state and you're facing the economic realities of what a prolonged strike might look like. You're in a complicated position as to you want to support the union, but you're also trying to figure out how to keep everything running. So it's very tricky as to how this is going to play out. And I think what you noted is the difference between what a Bernie Sanders might say and a Sean Fain might say versus what the governor might say. You know, at least they're all on stage together. but how much is each person committed to this fight?
I think they're working together here, though, in a certain way. I mean, you got the fire brands out there who are throwing the bombs, and that's what their role is. And then you've got the more moderate, that's not the right word, but more grounded leaders who actually have to make decisions, like Governor Whitmer. I mean, she's the one in charge, so she has to make more measured statements and be a little bit more riding the center line here a little bit. I think that the UAW is in a good position here because most people don't have a lot of sympathy for people who make outrageous sums of money like the CEOs of these major corporations and these top heavy executive positions. That's just kind of a loser when it comes to electoral politics. So I think as long as the UAW feels like they're on the right side of the polling on this, they can keep riding the strike out for as long as they can. They've got a measured approach to this to keep riding it. But I think the second they feel like the public's starting to turn on them and that it's actually going to hurt Joe Biden's reelection campaign, I think they can make a deal at any point. I mean, they could really cut a deal at any point and it would be a huge win for their members. You know, they could give their members a high 20s to low 30% in salary increase. I mean, holy cow. I mean, that's a great win. They probably scrap this whole tiered system. I don't think that's really a hard ask for the automakers to do that. And they could settle this thing probably in a couple of days if they wanted to. But I think they're getting a lot of good pop out of this. And I think they're trying to change a national attitude that the workers are getting squeezed here, that we've just gotten real top heavy. They can ride that messaging for a while. And I think they're doing it.
Yeah, 20 to 30% still isn't the 40% that we saw with the CEO pay raises the last couple of years. So they definitely, I think, have the winning message here. And I think, you know, Adam, you were talking about just kind of the forward thinking progress here. And I think one of the issues that Democrats and Republicans, but really more Democrats, have to be mindful of is what are the policy issues that they're pushing for that are going to have ramifications on UAW members? You know, if we're pushing to be more of an EV manufacturer state, that's going to have implications on the employees here in those factories. And so it's hard for them to take a hard line on the exact UAW priorities that they're asking for when they're also pushing for advancements in the industry that are going to have that ripple effect on the workers. And so I think them being careful is exactly right. They have to. This is a tricky line to walk, and they have the upper hand. The UAW at this point, I think, has the upper hand, and we'll see how long this goes on for.
Well, thank you so much, Adam Bightley and Angela Minicucci with Martin Waymire, for joining us today for our MERS Monday roundtable segment.
Thank you.
Get you out of my head. I'm spending all of-
And for this segment of today's podcast episode, we are hosting a roundtable discussion with two of Michigan's automotive journalists, Paul Eisenstein, the contributing editor of Headlight.News, and Jordan Grisleski of the Detroit News. We are here today to talk about an already unprecedented UAW strike that's going on against Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis. Nearly 13,000 of the UAW's 145,000 members, nearly 9%, have walked off the job as the union strikes for the first ever time, simultaneously against all three automakers in Ohio, Missouri, and in Michigan's own community of Wayne. While I am a political correspondent and policy reporter, I am super thankful for my friends in the automotive sector of journalism who have been covering the likeliness of this strike well beyond midnight of September 14th, the deadline that the UAW and automakers did not meet when it came to contract building. Paul, can you shed some light on the new dynamics at play here during this particular strike?
Well, it's not easy to give a full sense of what's going on. One has to go back a few years to understand that there was a huge corruption scandal at the UAW. We saw several of the former presidents go to jail, and a new leader come in a couple of years ago who really was in a very weak position. And he was challenged by a gentleman by the name of Sean Fain, generally not very well known within union circles. But he won after a very contested runoff election. And Fain is an avowed member of the progressive wing. So what you have is a new leader who's determined to show his strength and to position himself not as just a lame duck, but to really make a stand, make his name in the union world. He has taken a very aggressive stand, and he's basically broken all the rules that you had before. And that's why you have, as you mentioned, a historic situation where not only do you have a strike, but a strike against all three automakers simultaneously.
You know, that is so interesting to think about the political dynamics at hand, with Sean Fain being very much seen as this progressive. And the UAW, I feel like for a significant part of time, was viewed as being more part of the establishment sector of the Democratic Party.
Right.
What are relationships right now? Do you see the UAW as a divided union at this point?
I think that he has actually done a very good job of uniting the union. And the companies didn't help in some ways. First of all, they made it easy to become targets based on the very high dollar figures that were quite well known for some of their top executives, notably CEOs like Mary Barra, who all in, including stock bonuses and the like, was coming in at over $29 million. There were a lot of concessions that the union made going back to the Great Recession. And they didn't get back a lot of those things, which I think the union members had expected to recover once the automakers recovered. But seeing the tremendous profits that they've earned over the last few years has only made it easier for Sean Fain to really rally the troops. I see no sign of the union being divided right now. And I think his unusual tactic, this triple strike, but at the same time, keeping it small so you don't have the entire industry out, has again excited the members with a sense of solidarity across the UAW rather than just being within one targeted manufacturer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I kind of agree. I think that Sean has been very effective at kind of connecting these contract negotiations with broader issues that affect everyone in the working class. He's been very, vocal about the fact that he sees this as something that goes well beyond the UAW. He talks a lot about the billionaires economy versus the working class economy and how the economy that we have today in the United States does not work for working people. And so I think he's been effective at kind of, you know, connecting issues like a shorter work week, improvements in wages, all of these things to a broader working class struggle that I think probably resonates with people beyond party affiliations.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Jordan. The union movement had lost a lot of momentum over the last 30 to 40 years. Ronald Reagan did an effective job of delegitimizing unions. He broke the air traffic controller union and so on. But we've seen all the data are showing that union support is rising rapidly. And I think that the emergence of people like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and so on, who are really turning into sort of the American oligarch class, has helped revive unionization. The two parties take, political parties take very, very different views on it. But I think they do so. I think the Republicans do so in particular with caution, because I think even some of the strong supporters, say, of Donald Trump are starting to get reactivated as they realize that there is a very distinct difference between the oligarchs and the working men and women of the country. I'm not trying to be political myself. I'm just saying that it's very obvious that there's growing division in the country among working class people who feel like they are somehow being cheated out of a good living while the oligarch class continues to gain power.
There's also a EV conversation going on right now, correct? The UAW is trying to figure out what is going to be their role in the future with this new automotive industry. And will these automakers make sure that there's a place for them, right?
Exactly. We know that it takes fewer workers in an apples to apples situation to build an EV than it does to build a regular car. And I say in an apples to apples situation because right now EVs are being produced in relatively low volume and they don't have the benefit of the economies of scale of internal combustion engine vehicles. But once you get the volume up, once you get more plants that are specifically focused on EVs, you're going to have a situation where fewer workers are needed. And that raises the risk that we'll see an even further decline in the UAW membership. Remember, this was a union that had, over a million auto workers in the United States represented going back 30, 40 years. Now, the number is down to 150,000. But this is an issue that we're going to feel across the industry. And incidentally, one of the interesting points that has been raised a couple of times, some stories that I've read that I find quite interesting, is the concern that the winner in all of this may not be the UAW workers, but Tesla. Tesla has an extremely efficient manufacturing base. Their cost is substantially lower than the Detroit 3. And that's going to be a problem, especially if the union raises costs or limits productivity gains that are necessary to compete. The flip side, and here's the flip side to this, there has been growing concern within the workforce at Tesla. Now, will workers there look at this and realize how much better off UAW members might be at the end of the strike? And will this foster a stronger union drive at Tesla?
Yeah, I think the stakes are really high here for the union, for the reason that Paul just mentioned, that, likely there are workers in the electric vehicle industry that exist today looking at the UAW's fight for a better contract and no doubt wondering if that would serve them. But I think there's also a sense, both among the union's leadership and among the rank and file membership, that this is their moment and they can't miss it, because now is the time when these investments are being made. We have battery plants being built and in some cases in operation already. And these negotiations only happen once every 4 years. So now is their time to kind of stake their claim to these jobs being union represented and to having the same or better standards than legacy manufacturing jobs.
Jordan, you just hit on something which we should bring up as well. Much of the conversation that has gone public has focused on wages and benefits. Bringing up wages by, you know, we've heard Sean Fain originally asking for close to 50% increases. It'll probably be somewhere in the 30s. We've heard about rejigging pensions and improving benefit, other benefits. So that certainly grabs attention. One of the things I want to watch when this settlement is finally reached, what sort of changes were made in terms of productivity? Will there be some trade-off? Will the union actually accept in return for better wages and such an increase in productivity that allows the manufacturers to reduce the amount of labor needed in building an electric vehicle? Or will they try to freeze where things are so that, you know, critics would call it feather bedding, that the automakers are not going to be able to really take advantage of the increased productivity they can get out of an electric vehicle? That could be the biggest challenge of all. If the companies aren't able to get the improved productivity that they feel they need to compete with the likes of Tesla, that could make this a very, very, very costly and inefficient settlement, whatever comes out.
When you all think about demands and you're talking to individuals who are currently on strike right now, those auto workers, which of the demands do you think has the crowd most fired up right now?
Well, I would say that one demand that always rises to the front and center of every interview I ever do with an auto worker is the issue of the tier system. I think it's very striking to me, even in interviews with folks who have worked there for decades and are at the top of the wage scale, pretty much universally, they say it is not fair that my coworker who stands across the line from me and does the same job as me makes substantially less money than me and has worse benefits. And that's really been kind of a theme of every conversation I have with any UAW represented worker. I was on the picket line on Thursday night when the strike was just being called, and I met a family of auto workers, and there was a mother there with her daughter, and they both work at Ford plants. And the mother, who's worked in the industry for decades, basically said, "This job allowed me to raise a family, and that is not true for my daughter today, who is a single mother and, you know, has to get a second job to support herself." So just, I think the fact that there is the disparity in wages and the lengthy, you know, up to 8 years grow-in period, which, you know, there's been some movement on that in the talks, but that really strikes me as something that there's pretty much universal disdain for among the membership.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the automakers would have been wise to set a phase-out date on that with the last contract. Some of them have been better than others at winding down the two-tier, but it's still there. You're absolutely right, Jordan. That's a real issue. Contract workers is another issue. The automakers try to defend it. And in fact, they sometimes will turn it upside down and point out that one of the challenges they have is a high level of unreported absenteeism, where people just don't show up. And their claim is that they need to keep temps on hand just so that on those rare days they can call in somebody to fill in a spot when somebody didn't show up. I know that's one of the demands that the companies have put on the table, is to try to reduce the level of unreported absenteeism. Those are critical issues, but I think another thing, and it's not something you will see directly addressed in a contract, but I think that one of the things that also motivates workers a lot is just the large, well, in some cases, huge pay that C-level executives are getting, particularly the CEOs.
Now, when you cover things such as the threat of these manufacturing jobs going abroad, do you view that as an empty threat, or is that a threat that you're taking very seriously as a reporter?
It is definitely a threat, and it's interesting to see that the Canadians, who are also have also been negotiating, were trying to take a much more positive, proactive approach to working with the companies. And I think one of the reasons was they've lost a lot of jobs. They've lost a lot of production in recent decades. They'd like to see some of that move back to Canada. And there is a plus to that, because under the rules passed with the Inflation Reduction Act, you can build a car in Canada and still qualify that vehicle, if it's electric, for the $7,500 federal tax credits. The Biden administration did give a gift to the union, and they have to recognize that, in that the domestic sourcing rules for assembling a car, for building batteries, and even sourcing the materials means you're seeing a lot of automotive production actually heading back to the United States. So that's a plus, because otherwise manufacturers can't get their vehicles the $7,500 tax credits. On the other hand, this is as much a benefit for non-union factories as it is for big three unionized plants.
And that also gets to some of the political tensions at play here, because we've seen the UAW, actually push back and, be in some ways critical of the Biden administration and say, we want these incentives and subsidies that are, flowing into the industry to benefit union workers, and push for, strings to be tied to some of that money. We've seen them withhold their endorsement for now for Biden in 2024 as they seek to get their demands met.
I do have to think about this through a political vision, because obviously you had Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer speak at the Friday Stand Up rally for the UAW that also featured Sean Fain and progressive U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Now, I wonder, what is the UAW's perception of the governor at this time period? Because while she says that she really does love her auto worker brothers and sisters, she also gave Ford $1 billion in incentives to build that battery plant in Marshall. How does this work amid the backdrop of Michigan providing financial incentives to the big three auto workers?
Well, I think that's a positive in many ways. Getting the battery plant here, both for Michigan and Michigan workers. One of the things that I think has really been a solid for Gretchen Whitmer has been her push, and of course, a state now Democratic legislature repealing the right to work. That was a big plus, because there were enough people in the auto plants, not by any means even close to a majority, but you did see some activists within the factories break out and try to get their colleagues to break out of the union. So the Democrats certainly have scored well with Michigan auto workers.
I would agree with that. I get the sense that the union has a pretty positive relationship with Governor Whitmer. She's often in attendance at their events, and President Sean Fain has not shied away from being openly critical or openly skeptical of the Biden administration. And we haven't seen any of that rhetoric directed at the governor, but, at least publicly.
So because of that right to work repeal that is going to be enacted starting next year. So just to confirm, that means that whatever the UAW wins through this already historic strike, a worker will not be able to qualify for that win next year unless they're paying their dues, correct?
Well, you can't work at the factories now without paying your dues. Anybody who wasn't a union member on the assembly line, as far as I know, they have to be union members now. Those are closed shops again.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Whereas before or currently, you could opt not to pay dues and still get the benefits of the collective bargaining agreement now in the UAW plants that are UAW represented, you will be obligated to pay dues.
By the way, before we wrap up, I want to get back to something. Jordan, you talked about the other plants that the manufacturers are setting up, battery plants in particular. That's become also a source of concern for the UAW. What you have are these plants that are essentially separate corporations. And there are a number of them with the battery plants. The manufacturers have taken the position, we can't automatically unionize those plants. And technically, they're correct, because in some cases, they may be in a joint venture with LG Energy or Samsung or any of a number of other companies that that are doing joint ventures to set up battery plants, and in some cases, other electric vehicle parts. Workers want to make sure that those plants, which will be an essential part of the auto business going forward, are represented.
I think one of my final questions I would love to poke at here is that obviously there is the Detroit Auto Show. And Jordan, I know you and I were talking about this personally beforehand, that it kind of seems that the auto show has really taken a backseat to this strike. How would you describe the energy right now in downtown Detroit?
Yeah, I was downtown on Friday evening, and it was really kind of striking if you're an observer of the auto industry to see people in, you know, black tie outfits heading to the auto show's charity preview. And literally right next door, there was a massive UAW rally going on, headlined by Bernie Sanders, thousands of auto workers and their supporters in a sea of red marching down Jefferson Avenue. So it was kind of a striking contrast of, you know, here's this event that is so, you know, closely watched and followed by members of the auto industry and its supporters. And then, you know, you have the union making its mark just down the street.
No. And before we wrap up here, do either of you have any additional comments you'd like to share?
I think it's going to be very interesting the next few days to watch. I think that Fain will continue to stress how far apart they are, but I'm not necessarily certain that they are as far apart as some reports are indicating. I think we will know within the next 3 to 4 days whether this is going to be quickly resolved or could run on for some time. We have to remember that the last time there was a strike 4 years ago, the UAW walked the picket lines against General Motors for 40 days. If this drags on, we're going to see a lot more plants go out. We could see Fain call the entire workforce out if he's really dissatisfied. If that happens, and if it stretches on, the impact will spread far beyond Detroit. Remember that there's a multiplier effect here. According to the industry itself, every union job impacts about 11 and a half other jobs across the American economy. So if everyone walked out, we'd be talking about almost 2 million people directly or indirectly impacted by an expanded strike. There's a lot of pressure on the union to move, but there's also a huge amount of pressure on the automakers.
Absolutely. I think that sums it up well. You know, we have three plants out on strike right now. The union has said that they will not hesitate to take out another round of plants if they feel it's necessary. There's a lot of moving pieces right now with, you know, the potential for more plants to go out. The union actively at the bargaining table with all three automakers right now. So there will likely be some progression in the talks this week. You have the Biden administration sending a team to Detroit. So there's a lot at play here, and, you know, all eyes are still going to be on Detroit for some time to come.
Jordan, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today on the MERS Monday podcast. And also thank you all so much for your amazing coverage of, like I said, this already historic event. It has definitely assisted me.
Thank you, Sam.
My pleasure to be with you.
Joining us near the end of today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast is Keith Lowry. a staff attorney for the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic Violence and Sexual Violence. Heath additionally serves as the coalition's policy specialist, ultimately being a liaison with state legislators on domestic and sexual violence issues and possible legislative reactions. He speaks with us today to specifically talk about legislation that received testimony last week in the Senate Civil Rights, Judiciary, and Public Safety Committee, Senate Bill 471 and Senate Bill 472, to prohibit an individual from possessing, purchasing, or selling firearms or ammunition for 8 years if they've been convicted of a misdemeanor related to domestic violence. Heath, before we dive into this legislation and other topics, can you tell us, tell our listeners more about yourself? How did you get into this work? And what does a typical day look like for you?
Yes, I've been with the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence since 2019. And before that, I served as a legislative director in the Michigan House of Representatives. Since my time began at the coalition, I've served as a staff attorney representing survivors in courts across the state and in tribal courts regarding crime victims' rights, civil proceedings, even housing and things of that nature, providing wraparound legal services along with my colleagues here. And a lot of my role now includes legislative, being a liaison between our multidisciplinary policy committee and the legislature and other policymakers. On an average day, I provide education to policymakers regarding issues that impact survivors of domestic and sexual violence and human trafficking, and the service providers that provide these services to these survivors. Our coalition is an organization that represents over 70 of these service providers across the state, representing every county in the state.
I know federal law, and I'm going to dive into the legislation right now, that Senate Bill 471 and that Senate Bill 472 by Senator Chang. I know federal law already bans those convicted in any court of a misdemeanor domestic violence crime from possessing firearms or ammunition. And that is for life, correct? That federal law?
Yes. There are limitations on regarding which type of relationship is involved in the domestic violence, but yes, as it is currently understood, yes.
So in your experience, I mean, why does your coalition feel that the federal law isn't enough?
Because the majority of law enforcement in the state is performed by state actors, such as state police, county law enforcement, and local municipal law enforcement. And they are not authorized to enforce this federal restriction. So they need a state law that mirrors the federal law to ensure that people who are convicted of misdemeanors involving domestic violence are able to be prohibited from possessing firearms in this state. And in addition, there are some limitations to the federal prohibition and how it applies to certain areas of Michigan law as well.
And could you just illustrate for us a potential scenario where a state law enforcement officer, such as a Michigan State Police trooper, is going after someone who could be at risk of harming their partner with a firearm or a former partner, and unfortunately they hit a wall because of lack of this legislation? You know, can you name a scenario?
Yes, if a person has committed a misdemeanor involving domestic violence, a police officer may know that this federal prohibition exists, but because they don't have the authorization to enforce federal law and this relationship with federal law enforcement via prosecution, they can't act under that federal law to remove the firearm from that individual or to proceed in charging that person as well.
Is there like a wait time when it comes to getting a federal officer, like someone with the FBI, on this issue?
Yes, because federal government is charged with enforcing federal laws across all states. So, and they just lack the resources comparative to state actors to enforce laws. So there's a lack of resources from the federal level to enforce this prohibition.
While doing my own research around this legislation, I came across a study from 2004 that found amid a sample of misdemeanor domestic batterers, 55% of offenders disclosed they were residing with their victim at the time of their sentencing. What does the prevalence of that look like in Michigan? And is it cases like those that this legislation would more directly address?
Yeah, so we have an empowerment philosophy in our organization, and we know that sometimes survivors, for whatever their reason, choose to still reside with the perpetrator, and they're allowed to make that choice because they know their most safe situation for them and how to go about, and they have to live their life, and we can't make that decision for them. And in those cases, domestic violence is 5 times more likely to lead to death if the perpetrator has access to a firearm. It's just about reducing that lethality is what these bills are really about. As terms to the actual numbers and how prevalent that is, I can speak anecdotally, but I do not know the actual figures for that.
Do you believe that anything more needs to be done with this legislation to ensure that this ban is being imposed on people that are truly dangerous?
I do believe that the current structure of the bill, it's a two-pronged analysis. A person must be convicted of this list of crimes, a crime on this list, but there also must be a domestic relationship between the person who has been convicted and the victim in that case. And it's, this sort of limits the pool of people who are covered under this prohibition to who we're targeting, which is those domestic violence perpetrators and the lethality that they bring to situations. And while I would love to see a relinquishment part of this language, which is a formal procedure for the firearms to be removed from these people who have been convicted, to let them know, to have them have a way to turn over firearms that are already in their possession in a safe and organized manner, I would love to see that. And it would prove, and has proven effective in reducing lethality in many states.
So could you just kind of list over, when we think about a domestic violence related misdemeanor, what all crimes does that include?
In this law, there's quite a few. There's assault and battery, assault with a weapon that it doesn't raise to a felony level, breaking and entering, vulnerable adult abuse, destruction of personal property of another, destruction of a house, barn, and other buildings, stalking, criminal sexual conduct, and use of telecommunications with intent to terrorize and intimidate and harass another person. These crimes are often used in domestic violence situations rather than just the plain assault and battery domestic violence law, whether through plea deals or the ability and evidence to prove these actions. These are usually a pattern of escalating violence that we see in domestic violence situations.
How do you think our current judicial system, with how it stands, does with going after these incidents and also giving them the appropriate amount of due process?
In our current system, there's usually a long history of acts before a person that actually receives a conviction under our current system. And even then, the first charge of domestic violence is usually deferred under another statute in the state. So it takes a long time before someone reaches the point of actually being convicted of these crimes. So there are substantial due process rights, as there is, and as is meant to be in our criminal justice system. Regarding the ability of someone to be prosecuted and how often we see that, each county has its own prosecutor who has the discretion to charge different crimes. And often, a lot of these crimes are very hard to prove because of the lack of witnesses outside of the survivor and the perpetrator. So we always contend that there's a lack of prosecution of every crime, but we do understand the barriers that exist for people within the system.
I'm assuming that given your role, you have probably been going around to different legislative offices, talking to lawmakers about these bills. Do you have any personal predictions of what the vote might look like when it gets on the board? Do you think that this is going to be a party line vote?
In my job, I provide a lot of education to legislators, and I have been doing my due diligence along with other stakeholders to make sure that everyone understands the importance of these. I do believe there's a path to these bills becoming law, but it's not, the fight's not over and in that regard. And while I don't do so much direct lobbying, please vote for this sort of discussions, I do believe that many stakeholders and policymakers understand the importance and life-saving aspects of this law.
But when you think about legislators who might be have some early hesitation about this legislation, I mean, where do you think that hesitation comes from?
There has been the pattern of wanting to reform the criminal justice system in various ways. And we want to make sure that we're protecting people's rights in all ends and making sure that there isn't a miscarriage of justice in these sorts of enforcement. We believe that these are post-conviction prohibitions. There's been a great standard of due process allotted to these people that have been convicted. And many of those sorts of, during the process itself, protections that people want to see are not necessarily as much of a burden on this as they would be in other situations.
I did cover your remarks during last week's Senate committee testimony, and you talked a lot about the sensations of fear that come among survivors as they wait for a previous partner to get released from a jail sentence, and then they're terrified about what's going to happen next, and they're uprooting their lives. It seems that this legislation does aim to ultimately, if anything, make people feel safer.
And yes, feel safer and actually be safer is what I want to say, because that fear is well founded in the statistics regarding domestic violence. These people believe the survivors believe perpetrators when they say they aim to end their lives. And I've seen the trauma and the fear and dread that comes along with that. And these laws are aimed to reduce that as much as possible. It will not get rid of every bit of danger for every survivor, but each step towards a safer society is appreciated.
But I also know some of the individuals that have very courageously shared their stories in testimony in support of this legislation. Sometimes they were threatened with a firearm, or they were reciting with a dangerous partner who possessed a firearm, but that partner never had a misdemeanor of this nature. So a question I have, is it more likely for them to have a misdemeanor before this act of firearm-related violence? Or is it more likely for there not to be that misdemeanor in the first place?
There are many barriers to reporting crimes of this nature. It's due to societal pressures, but also systemic pressures to making sure that there's actually a conviction. I mentioned it slightly earlier. There's around 7 or 8 instances of reporting usually before there's a conviction of any sort. So the likelihood of there being a misdemeanor ahead of time is limited, but in other states, they've seen anywhere between 10 and 14% reduce in domestic violence homicides with similar laws. And we're looking to see that same sort of reduction in the state. Maybe not everyone will be able to benefit from this, but those that can are worth saving. It's worth saving their lives.
I was also hoping by having you on the podcast today, we could also get some updates on some other things. I know that the U.S. Supreme Court is poised to hear oral arguments in November, this November, around United States versus Rahimi, which challenges the constitutionality of the federal ban on gun possession by those subjected to domestic violence restraining orders. Could you give us listeners a little bit more of an idea of what this case is about? And what is your own coalition's level of concern?
The Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence has participated in an amicus brief regarding this case. Rahimi is of great concern to domestic and sexual violence service providers across this country. That case looks to review the constitutionality of firearm prohibitions for individuals subject to a domestic violence restraining order, similar to our personal protection orders in that state. And while this particular 471 and 472 do not have anything included regarding personal protection orders, we still see those sorts of prohibitions found in those orders to be very valuable and necessary to make sure that survivors have a safe avenue away from domestic violence involving firearms.
Do you think, depending on where the U.S. Supreme Court goes with the U.S. versus Rahimi case, could that even break down the constitutionality of the red flag legislation that Michigan recently passed?
I believe there is a different standard for the extreme risk protection orders that recently were enacted. As regarding the impact of Rahimi on those, I would leave that to the court of this state and to in their interpretation. I can't speak on what the possible outcome of Rahimi is regarding what the actual opinion will say. That will determine whether extreme risk protection orders are affected by that final determination.
And I know in that case, it is an individual out in Texas who physically abused his partner in a parking lot, dragged her to his car, threatened her with a firearm, was placed under a restraining order, and then firearms were later detected during a home search. And I know that while he was given a six, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying my hardest out here. So he was given a 6-year prison sentence, and then a federal court judge out in, was he out in Louisiana, correct?
I believe so, yes. In that same circuit there. Yeah.
And he ultimately states that this restraining order firearm-related ban goes beyond what the founding fathers would have expected when it comes to the design of the Second Amendment, correct?
That's the crux of that argument, yes.
And I mean, what are your personal thoughts about seeing this? What are your reactions just talking about this U.S. Supreme Court case in the news?
While I believe there's many things that exist in our current society that were unable to be contemplated by the framers of the Constitution, I do believe that there was a culture of understanding danger and the danger that possession of firearms even occurred that could co-occur with dangerous people having dangerous means of creating more danger in life-threatening situations. I believe that this domestic violence restraining order prohibition is well-grounded in a reasonable society. Beyond that, it's the merits of that opinion are, I didn't personally participate in the drafting of the brief in response, but the danger that could be created by following that opinion and applying it nationwide is too great of a risk.
No, definitely. And I also want to talk about another big thing that happened last week, which was the address confidentiality program now becoming available to survivors of domestic violence in Michigan. And that became available on September 13th, so not too long ago. Could you tell us a little bit more about the program and kind of some of the feelings your coalition might be feeling, being able to connect that with your clients?
Yes, the coalition clearly and our member program see this as an excellent tool to improve safety from a set of survivors who face a greater risk for having their address exposed to a perpetrator. This program would allow anyone who has been a victim of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, human trafficking, or even just thinks they're at a risk of being threatened or physically harmed by having an address disclosed to the public. These people also must be in the process of moving to a new address for this to sort of go into effect. But this program, our coalition was a big proponent of it when it passed in 2020. And we're happy to see that it's been activated within the Attorney General, Department of Attorney General. And we'd love to see how it interacts in safety planning for many of our member programs and the survivors that they serve. This is something we've been waiting for quite a while.
So what's the next step moving forward to make sure that survivors are utilizing this program?
Knowledge is the first step, and making sure that there's trained advocates across the state who are able to help guide survivors through this process. There is an application review by advocates within the department, but also people assisting the survivor put in an application in the first place.
And beyond just, and I'm going to pivot back to the Senate bills that we kicked off this conversation talking about, but beyond just that, I mean, what else is the coalition looking for in terms of policy for this current term?
One of the main issues that many of our member programs are seeing is not only issues of safety, but access to housing for many survivors trying to leave a dangerous situation. They need somewhere to go. And many of our member programs operate shelters, but the shelters have no place for survivors to eventually move into on their own. So housing access has been a major goal of ours to improve that for survivors across the state, and having the resources to serve them as we see reductions in funding from the federal level for many of our domestic and sexual violence programs. And so the state has, in the most recent budget, applied $30 million to victim services, and we're looking to keep and maintain and most likely increase that sort of funding to make sure that these programs that provide life-saving services across the state are able to keep operating, even with reductions from the federal level.
No, well, thank you so much, Heath, for joining us for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast, which I believe, is this the first time that we've had membership from the coalition on our podcast?
To my knowledge, I believe so. As I've said, I've only been here since 2019, but this is the first time hearing of it. So I'm glad to participate. I've been a listener and I'm happy to be having this conversation.
No, thank you so much. And again, everyone, that is Heath Lowry, a state attorney for the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence. Thank you so much, Heath. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our initial morning roundtable participants, Vice President Adam Bitely of Public Affairs at Martin Wehmeyer and Martin Wehmeyer partner Angela Minicucci. Additionally, thank you to business and auto reporter Jordan Grzelewski of the Detroit News and contributing editor Paul Eisenstein of Headlight.News, as well as to staff attorney Heath Lowry of the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence. I'd also like to give a huge thanks to MERS editor Kyle Mullen. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Shriver.